I want to discuss a matter that I think has great bearing on our current Jewish world, and to put it in some sort of perspective. Really, what the issues that are involved in today's Jewish world are really the issues of the 19th century. To a great extent, we've never gotten over those issues, even though the world has certainly changed for us in the 150 years since then. But the 19th century is a defining century because of the fact that that is the century where the Jewish people became secularized. There were major forces that encouraged it. So it's hard for us to put ourselves into the mindset of past centuries. There's something called a Zeitgeist, which in German means the spirit of the times. So the spirit of the times has gone. It's not here. And therefore, it's not easy for us to understand why people behaved as they did, and why the masses of the world, the Jewry, to a great extent became secularized. There were two types of assimilation that existed in Europe then. One type of assimilation represented by reform in Germany and in France and in England was an assimilation of convenience. It was a chance to get ahead in the world. And retaining Jewish customs, Jewish observances, was always seen as being a hindrance. So, you know, if you wanted to make it in the world, you have to become at least visibly less Jewish. And basically it also required adopting non-Jewish values and the ideas that were current then. This type of assimilation, which, by the way, is the assimilation that exists in the United States today, is based on pleasure, on money, on position, basically, again, on getting ahead in the world. And since the Jews had been held down by the Christian society for so many centuries, when the ghetto walls began to fall and Jews obtained the rights to be citizens and civil rights, so then there naturally was an inclination, you know, like someone that hasn't eaten in a long time will probably overeat at the first meal. So there was an inclination to become assimilated in the world. That reflected itself in Reform Judaism in the 19th century, because in the 19th century, eventually, over 250,000 Jews from Germany, Bohemia, Hungary, basically Central Europe, England as well, converted to Christianity. The largest mass conversion of Jews voluntarily in the history of the Jewish people. Because after a period of time it became obvious that being less of a Jew was still not enough, and that the only way to really get ahead was to be not Jewish at all. Now, you're talking about a time when Judaism was a religion. It was not yet a race. it becomes a race in the 20th century. Once it becomes a race, then it doesn't make any difference whether the Jew is Christian or not. There's no hope for him. But in the 19th century, there was a religion. You have the famous case of the Disraeli family in London. So the elder Disraeli was a member of the Bevis Marx congregation in London, which was, and it still operates, it's the oldest Smarta congregation in London, dates from the 1700s, even when Jews were not officially allowed back yet, but Jews came already. The government did not enforce it. Cromwell let him back, but then when Charles II came, he de-Cromwelled everything. So the Board of Governors of the Bevis Marx congregation came to Disraeli's father and said to him, "We want to appoint you to be a Parnas of the congregation." A Parnas was like a gabbai, some an official, an officer of the congregation. The word Parnas in Hebrew means to provide sustenance. And that was really what the name meant in the synagogue, too. If you were Parnas, you had to ante up a certain amount of money for the support of the congregation. It was an honor that came with a cost. Disraeli's father resented this pressure being put upon him, and he therefore resigned from the congregation. And he took his two sons, one of whom was Benjamin Disraeli, and he converted them to the Anglican Church. That shows you, right? That takes care of it. And Disraeli had the distinction of being a Jew and an Anglican at the same time. I'm sure he had other. And the main reason was that he wanted his children to get ahead. He wanted to get ahead in England. I mean, he never could have become Prime Minister if he wasn't an Anglican. He never would have gotten to Parliament, etc. The only ones that... You had the famous case of Lord Rothschild, who was elected to Parliament a number of times, but who...
Mr. Rothschild of the time.
What?
It was Mr. Rothschild of the time.
Yeah, and he, he was a leading banker in England, but he refused to take his seat in the House because he had to swear a Christian oath. And it was not till much, much later in the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century, when that was eliminated. So if Disraeli wanted to be Disraeli, he had to be an Anglican. But that was a trend throughout Western Europe. Gustav Mahler, the famous conductor and composer, his lifelong ambition was to be the conductor of the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra, which was and still is one of the premier symphony orchestras in the world. Even though he was vastly qualified for the job, and he already had an international reputation for his compositions, he was never granted the job because he was Jewish. And his desire for the job was so great that he converted. He got the job. Of course, when he got the job, the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra sabotaged him anyway. They never played well for him when he conducted. His reputation as a conductor was really made with the New York Philharmonic, where he was guest conductor for a number of years. But that was the ticket. That was the way to get in. Heinrich Heine, who was the great German poet, lived in France most of his life, but he wrote in German, he also wasn't a converted. He wrote that the ticket for admission to Western society is conversion.
I met one of his descendants in Alberta.
Yeah, well, so he was a bitter person all of his life because of it. He had a great deal of self-hatred. He was somehow with all these people were Jews and not Jews, which is the worst of all situations. But a lot of people were willing to pay that ticket. So you have in Germany today, it's estimated that you have perhaps over 1 million people that have Jewish blood in them that are good Germans. There was a book written about the German generals in the Second World War. Some of them were direct descendants of Jews. Under Nuremberg laws, they should have been in Auschwitz, but Hitler needed them. So therefore, they were able to continue.
Which ones?
I don't remember from the book, but I don't think it's any of the real famous ones, but they were like division commanders.
Was there one famous brutal German high officer?
Germany is full of people that are of Jewish descent. Just as Spain is full of people of Jewish descent. Francisco Franco himself was of Jewish descent. That's one of the reasons why he never gave the Jews who escaped to Spain back to the Germans. The Swiss gave back, others gave back. Spain never gave anybody back. He said that under the Nuremberg laws they'd probably take him too. So, all over Central Europe, you had this tremendous wave of assimilation. That really, the assimilation, the conversion, was the defeat of Reform Judaism in Germany. Because by the end of the 19th century, Reform was pretty much played out in Germany already. Because it only served as a conduit to Christianity. The children, the grandchildren, were not going to be Reformed Jews. It's pretty much, unfortunately, a situation which exists in the United States today, where Reform has become the haven for mixed marriages. 90% of the cases, the children of mixed marriages are not raised as Jews. So therefore, the next generation is not going to be Reformed. So this type of assimilation, which, as I mentioned, is pretty much the assimilation that exists today in the Jewish world as well, is built upon ignorance. It's built upon the values of the dominant society. And it's built upon the idea that that's how we get ahead. And the Jews have always a tremendous desire to get ahead, whatever they're at. We are a restless, aggressive people. And therefore, that became part of the makeup. The second type of assimilation, which took place mainly in Eastern Europe, not exclusively, but mainly in Eastern Europe, was an ideological assimilation. It was the adoption of an ideology to substitute for Judaism. And it was not because it was more comfortable. In fact, it was more dangerous because it involved being a subversive to the government. But it was an ideological type of assimilation. Marxism, in all of its variant forms, socialism, communism, etc., was a tremendously attractive ideology to 19th century Jewry, because Marxism provided a promise of a utopian solution to all human problems. And Jews love utopian solutions. We want to solve everything at one shot, and everybody should go home happy. And therefore, Marxism became really a secular messianism. You know, everything was going to be good. It especially attracted Jews because the Jews in Eastern Europe were persecuted, poverty-stricken, a poverty that we cannot imagine. And Marxism promised an end to persecution because everybody was going to be equal. And it promised economic welfare beyond imagination. And it said that the capitalists would no longer exploit the working class. All of which had a great appeal to the Jews, especially the Jewish youth. The Jewish youth were not willing to take it anymore. And therefore, for instance, anarchy, the anarchists, which really is a very strange type of belief, had many Jewish supporters. And the Marxists, revolutionaries, Jews were heavily involved. So this was a different type of assimilation. This was an assimilation where you took Judaism out of the equation and substituted it with something. You had it even in our time, you may still have it in our time, in some of the left-wing kibbutzim here in Israel. Their Pesach Seder is according to Marx. They have a entire booklet with Marx's sayings and everything, and that's the text of the Seder. So there's a direct substitution in front of your eyes of taking the traditional Judaism and substituting Marxism for it. We have a little of that today, and without I don't want to be extreme about it, but you have a little of that today with the Greens, for instance. That everything has to be green, right? So that became the religion of the Jews. We're going to save the environment. We're going to save the world from global warming. That's the that's the religion. Or women are entitled to have abortions anytime they want to have. That's a religious tenet. Not a Jewish tenet, but it became amongst Jews a religious tenet. And all sorts of other things such as that. Those are ideological tenets. Now, in Eastern Europe, after the Marxist ideas, then there came Zionism, which is also an ideology. And for the Zionists, we're talking about the secular Zionists, Zionism replaced Judaism. That was now the Jewish faith. And everything else was not necessary. In fact, not only not necessary, it was probably a hindrance. So we live at a time when these ideologies are pretty much petered out, right? Very few dyed-in-the-wool communists left in the Jewish world, in anybody's world. And Zionism, unfortunately, is also pretty much on the wane, at least in terms of the original Zionists. There were the idea of Jews doing manual labor was the religious tenet. So you had to you could not hire non-Jewish labor to work on the farms or to work. Jews have to do it. Jews have to be the hod carriers. Jews have to be the stevedores. Jews have to be the garbage collectors. Avodah Ivrit. Jewish work. Well, today, you know, you got 180,000 Asians here picking our tomatoes and all sorts of other things. And
doing the work Israelis won't do.
That's right. Yeah, so that's exactly what happens, right? But so that the point that I'm making is that the ideologies of the 19th century are not here anymore. But the problems, the disagreements, the tremendous fights are still here, even though the world is so far different that it's hard to understand why they should keep on fighting about these things. What?
I heard it described by the daughter of a distinguished Israeli years ago in California that those early Zionists were so extreme that if one of the youth there got sick and couldn't work, they went out into the Mediterranean and drowned themselves.
They're nuts all over, right? That doesn't,
probably not too many of them, but
doesn't prove anything, but again, we're talking about an ideological assimilation. So, and this assimilation touched every family in Eastern Europe. The family of the great rabbis, their children went away. The families of the great Hasidic leaders. And so therefore it looked like an unstoppable movement. And from the yeshivot in Eastern Europe came the communists and the socialists and the Zionists and the radicals. Again, that's the zeitgeist, right? That's the spirit of the time. In the United States in the 1960s and 70s, there was a certain spirit of the time. Hippies, whatever you wanted to call it, but that swept the youth. And today, you know, it looks a little outmoded to us. But at that time, anyone who lived through it, that was it. Because of this assimilation, the traditional Jewish world found it very difficult to accommodate itself within what was going on. So in Germany, there were small pockets of Jewish observance, such as Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, such as Rabbi Nathan Bamberger, such as other Hildesheimer in Berlin, but their method was basically an accommodation to German society. They all spoke German, wrote in German. The members of their congregations all were people that were professionals or engaged in the secular world. That was a completely different brand of Judaism, so to speak, than what existed in Eastern Europe, even though it was halachically perfect. And they didn't do anything, but the comment on it is basically Hirsch's own wry comment, in which he said, my people are reverse Muranos. He said the Muranos were non-Jews on the outside and Jews on the inside. And my people, he said, are Jews on the outside and Germans on the inside.
I put my two cents in again. The neighborhood doctor where I grew up in Flatbush, Dr. Fischel, he had an MD and a PhD from Heidelberg, but he did his postgraduate work in a concentration camp.
Yeah. We know what happened to Germany. But I don't know if that proves anything. But that was one type of accommodation. In Eastern Europe, that accommodation did not exist. The traditional forces, both Hasidic and the Lithuanian yeshivas, did not allow for that accommodation.
They tightened down.
Hmm?
They tightened down.
So what they did is that they circled the wagons and they said, we're not going to change anything. We're not going to adapt, period. Because they saw the adaptations that were so harmful. This reflected itself in a number of things. First of all, from 1870 to 1914, over 2 million Jews emigrated to the United States and Canada and South Africa and other places. They just picked up and left. They left because of the poverty, because of the persecution. They left because of the promise. All of them felt that their generation would not benefit by it, but they felt that their children would, which is really what happened. The immigrant generation lived in the Lower East Side in very sad conditions, but their children moved to the Bronx and eventually to Scarsdale. They got out. They became successful. However, coming to the United States then was a disaster, religiously speaking. Could not remain a Sabbath observer. It was a 6-day work week. So
when are we talking right now again?
What?
When are we talking
about? The 1870s, 1880s. It was as late as in the 1950s.
Yes.
I remember when I first got my, when I became a member of a law firm in Chicago, a Jewish law firm, completely Jewish. So I told them in advance that I, you know, you couldn't get me Friday night and you can't get me on Saturday. I told them I'll come in Sunday for you, okay, no problem. I had the grades, whatever it was. And then, like 3 or 4 weeks into my career, I said, we've got a tremendous closing Saturday morning, and multi-million-dollar closing. We need everybody from the office there. We've got to do the prorations and everything. So you come. I told them, I'm not going to come. That was our agreement. They said, but this is millions of dollars. And they really didn't understand what I was talking about. And by the end of the year, I was out. And that's 1956.
Well, shul's in New York had early Shabbos morning minyan.
Yeah, my father had that in his shul in Chicago. They had 750 men that came Shabbos morning at 6 o'clock, davened, heard Kriyas HaTorah, got on the trolley and went to work. Their children didn't come to shul anymore. So because of that, and that was well known in Eastern Europe, that's what happened. And because of that, the religious figures in Eastern Europe vehemently opposed immigration. Because they felt... Now, this is all before First World War. It's all before the Shoah, before the Holocaust. Before everything that we know now. So you can't really judge, right? Because you're asking people to be prophetic when no one was prophetic. I just read a letter today written by a great Lithuanian rabbi to his nephew. The nephew was already in America. The nephew was an observant Jew, etc. But he was in America. So the nephew wrote a letter to his younger brother, who was in Lithuania, that he should try and come to America and his brother will help him. It's 1936. Hitler's already the chancellor. and they're living under terrible anti-Semitic conditions in all of Eastern Europe. And he wrote over, the uncle wrote a letter to the nephew and said, how dare you? You'll bring him to America, he'll be ruined. He said, better that he should live his entire life here in poverty in Lithuania rather than succumb to coming to America. So in hindsight, we read such a letter and we weep because the nephew never made it. Never got out, right? As most of Eastern European Jewry didn't get out. 90%, 98% of Lithuanian Jewry was destroyed. But that's all perfect hindsight.
But I have a question on that, really. Why do we weep if it's like they come to America to be destroyed anyway?
My friend, you see, this room... This room is full with descendants of people who got out.
And each person in this room is filled with family, even though they got out as being dead.
Right, so, but, you know, it depends how you look, the glass is half full. A dead Jew can't help anybody, that much we can say. Right?
Yeah.
Dead is dead. That's a great rule in life. In order to do something, you have to have people who are alive, right? So we'll see. We'll see what will happen. We'll see how it sorts out. But it's not criticism here. It's just to understand what happened, right? How it happened. And part of the problem was that the people who were the role models, right? The great rabbis, the great Hasidic leaders, their own children went away. So there were some of them that were sensitive enough, they changed their names. Especially here in Israel. They Hebraicized their names so that they didn't have, at first blush, you wouldn't recognize that the rabbi's son, the great rabbi's son. Peter Bergson, whose real name was Hillel Cook in the United States, he changed his name to Peter Bergson, because he did not want to shame the Cook family.
How
was
he in the Cook family?
He was a direct, he was a nephew, he was a direct descendant.
Son of a brother.
Yeah. So, there was that sensitivity. It was not only that they wanted to adopt Hebrew names, which they did, but it was also a fact that it signified that there was a break and something new was beginning. The Holocaust certainly changed the whole view of things. I remember that in Chicago, one of the I think not one of the leading. I think the leading student in our yeshiva. He already had smicha. When the when in 46 and 47, the first survivors of the Holocaust limped into Chicago and told their story. So he lost his faith. Because of that. Later moved to Israel. He became a very big man here, etc. He became a secular Jew completely. The Holocaust had that effect. And therefore, you know, like all of this is a black cloud that hangs on, hangs over us. It hasn't gone away. Now with the Zionist movement, you had a religious Zionist movement that arose. The Zionist movement originally said they wouldn't deal with religion, but very shortly they did, and they created cultural Zionism. The cultural Zionism was based upon the land, Much of it was based upon socialist ideas, because many of those who actually came to Israel were the leftists, socialists, the kibbutzim, etc. And they also negated everything that happened in the exile. The exile was complete disaster, which is also not true. I mean, great things were accomplished by the Jewish people in the exile. Is the exile the preferred form of living? No. No one said that. But to say that not that everything that was achieved in the exile should be forgotten or diminished, it was an extreme position, not justified, and terribly damaging. Now, when the religious Zionist movement began, when it became clear that the general Zionist movement was going to be very secular, so the religious Zionist movement began, and it was based upon the fact that living and loving the land of Israel is a mitzvah in the Torah, one of the commandments of the Torah. And it was based upon practical considerations as well. The Jews have to have somewhere to go. This would be a place to develop that Jews could come to. And it had this age-old idea of the return to Zion. So therefore, the religious Zionists, to a great extent, overlooked the secular nature of Zionism and concentrated on the traditional love of the land of Israel as their goal. Yes.
Why did the overwhelmingly secular Zionist organization reject the Uganda plan?
It didn't reject it. It passed. It just didn't happen. It was adopted at the 1904 Zionist Convention. But England was giving away something it didn't own, which is always a problem. The the majority, the large majority of traditional Jewry in Eastern Europe were anti-Zionist. It's true of the rabbis, true of the Hasidic leaders. There are exceptions. I mean, notable exceptions. But in the main, they opposed it. They opposed it because of its secular nature. They could not imagine that anything positive for the Jewish world would come from people who had no loyalty or concept of Jewish tradition. And therefore they opposed it. So just as the religious Zionists overlooked the secular nature, the others overlooked, so to speak, the land of Israel part and concentrated on the secular nature and opposed it.
Right.
And there's no right in any of this. There's no right. Events have overtaken everybody. And, what are you going to do now? You know, you got 5.5 million Jews living here. What are you going to do?
Well, eventually,
you can't, you know, rewind the reel.
Eventually, the Aguda accepted the fact that the state of Israel.
All right, so he's there. That's right.
What's it called? They accepted it as a halachic fact. They saw the other day in the Marian.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Marian.
Also, a lot of the rabbis encouraged the Gera rabbi.
Right, so that, so I'm telling you that they didn't encourage to be Zionists. They encouraged coming to the land of Israel. But what is the attitude towards it? You know, part of the problem is that, you know, you quote people that are dead for 130 years and say what they said then. How do you know what they would say now? How do we know that? How, you know, you caught people before the Holocaust, how do you know what they would say after the Holocaust? You caught people before the state existed, how do you know what they would say after the state exists? Or 60 years afterwards. So basically, it's a restatement of 19th century positions in the 21st century. What? Yeah. So there's again individuals. I'm talking in broad generalities. We go to Mayor Shoreham today. They didn't change their mind.
Thank you.
Yes.
When you took us to visit Batya and they talked about the real conflict, these were religious Russian shtetl Jews or small town Jews who were farmers that a great rabbi induced the Rothschilds to finance to come to Israel and form an agricultural settlement. But when they wanted to observe Shemitah, the Rothschilds' agents were secular Jews and they didn't like that.
So
that was a great conflict.
That's just one of the conflicts. You have all the other conflicts, right? Public transportation on Shabbat, all sorts of things, you know. So don't forget, you know, it was one thing Tel Aviv in 1920 when there were maybe 60 cars in the whole town. Right? So then Shabbat was one thing, right? Today, you know, you got 60,000 and everybody's driving, so then it's a different atmosphere. It's different than the Shabbat is openly destroyed. So you have these changes that occurred, but the positions have not much not changed that much. In for instance, we have the state of Israel. Okay, somebody told me a few days ago that he had a discussion. He's in medical school. He's finishing medical school. He took off 2 years to study here. He had a discussion with a certain rabbi who told him, he said, why do you go to medical school? He said, plenty of non-Jews can be doctors. So that's in the context of living in the shtetl, where you had a Shabbos goy, right? Well, that's what you had the non-Jews for. You know, the famous anecdote of Shalom Aleichem, that a Jew had a son that somehow got a scholarship to the University of Berlin. This Jew lived in a town. They had 35 Jews in town. Kid comes back after 4 years. And his father asked him, he said, how many Jews live in Berlin? He said, 35,000. He said, wow, 35,000 Jews. He said, how many non-Jews live in Berlin? He said, 3.5 million. He said, what do they need so many non-Jews for? So that's the typical shtetl outlook. But we're not in the shtetl anymore. So if there are no Jewish doctors in the state of Israel, so you're going to close shop. You got to leave. And if there are no Jewish engineers and no Jewish computers and whatever, well, you know, etc. So it's a completely different situation, but people still address it with the 19th century mindset. And even after the death of all of these foreign ideologies, so to speak, we're not fighting communism anymore. We're not fighting, we're not even fighting Zionism anymore, because there's not much Zionism left to fight. So then it becomes an issue as to what are we supposed to pursue? How, you know, like, what should our policies be? I'll give you just an example, and don't take it seriously. I know you didn't take the rest of the lecture seriously, so there's a whole contempt about the heter mechira regarding Shemitah, the selling of the land, the non-Jew, in order to accomplish the Shemitah. This was a halachic device that was created in the 1880s by European rabbis to protect a small Jewish farming community here in the land of Israel. It basically is a shtetl solution. Right? It's the solution, you know, you sell it to a non-Jew. It's, we're not involved. Whether or not that is the way to approach it now, 60 years into the state. So it's not just a halachic issue, it's an issue that has broad implications. How are we going to deal with these problems? Basically, how are we going to deal with operating a technologically advanced, first world, modern state according to Jewish tradition, according to halacha? That's the problem that faces us. So until now, we rely again on the non-Jews, we rely on the secular Jews. We don't have to dirty our hands. But eventually we're faced with the problem of how do we deal with such a situation? How do we create it? I find it very interesting that the proponents of the Heter Mechira, which are mainly in the religious Zionist camp, are willing to settle, so to speak, for a shtetl solution. And they're right. So it's a complicated problem, right? And because it's so complicated, but the point that I'm trying to make is that there has to be somehow a broader view of it. Not just it's not just the trees here; it's the forest. It's just the tip of the iceberg.
We already see that being changed, though.
Oh, so it's slowly it's being changed, right? There's something Otsar Oretz, Otsar Bezdin, because those are basically an accommodation to the fact that we're not in the shtetl anymore. And therefore we're going to deal with it differently. Yeah, right, so is that the answer? Right, you want the entire electrical grid in the country to be dependent upon non-Jews, who can throw one switch and everything is gone. Does that make sense? Or the telephone system in the Ministry of Defense, or the computers, there are 100 scenarios, right? So how do you deal with that? So it's going to take it takes 45 miles to turn around an aircraft carrier. In the ocean. So it's going to take a long time for us to turn around too, because it took us a long time to get into this problem. But the problems are real. And the question is how we deal with it. Now, Israel is far different than the United States. The United States assimilation based on complete ignorance, based on a hedonistic lifestyle, and it's many generations gone, and the fact that the Jews in the United States feel that anti-Semitism is a problem that's behind them already. And that Jew can be anything he wants to be. And the truth of the matter is that intermarriage takes two to tango. The non-Jew has to be willing to marry the Jew. For a long period of time in the United States, the intermarriage rate was very small because the non-Jew wouldn't marry the Jew. People didn't want a Jewish son-in-law. But that has also changed, right? If Carolyn Kennedy can marry a Jew, or Al Gore, his daughter, can marry a Jew, and all of that, so what's the problem? What? So because of that, the situation is far different than it is here. And to a certain extent, it may be easier to solve, and it may be very difficult to solve. I think the attrition rate will continue to be horrendous. I think the core is much stronger than it was. Certainly much stronger than it was when I grew up, or when I started out. The returns are still out as to what the future of American Jewry will be.
Well, the core gets stronger, though the outside gets much weaker and eroded.
Yeah, right. So then the question is, what's going to be, you know? Is it going to end up just the core? And if it does, then the core has to also undertake certain responsibilities, which it has not done until now. Again, we let somebody else do it, right? It's just lately starting to change, right? So you have Orthodox organizations that now are politically active. They now represent Jewish viewpoints. But these are things that as late as 30 years ago didn't exist.
Aguda has an office in Washington.
Yeah, right. Aguda, the OU, all of them, you know, it's a different ballgame. But again, that's part of the response to the fact that you can't really rely on the others. The others used to take care of us.
APEC?
Here is APEC is an example of this reliance, yes. But now who's going to be APEC? Especially if these two guys go to jail. The two guys that they're trying for because they gave information to Israel. So it's a very it's a treacherous thing, and we have to hope, continue to hope that the United States is the exception to all the rules of the Jewish exile. Whether it will prove to be in the very long, long run is something we don't know. You have to remember the Jews were in Spain for almost 900 years. In good shape. The Jews were in Germany for 1,000 years. The Jews were in Eastern Europe for 800 years. And many times they were also in very good shape and had autonomous government and all sorts of benefits. So it's not something that, God forbid, that we hope for, but it's something that has to be borne in mind that until now, the United States of America is the exception and not the rule. It's a completely different exile. And it's changed. It's changed because, you know, you can go to any hospital in the United States and see doctors that wear kippah, right, without prejudice. I remember that when I was a rabbi in Muncie, so there Muncie had the best of all worlds because it had a Catholic hospital and all Jewish doctors.
Good sound.
But that changed when you
were a youth. Wait a minute, so I'm just telling you. So what happened was, there was a time when Jews couldn't even get in the medical schools. And that's why they made, Yeshiva University with Einstein, the medical school, broke the barrier to a great extent, the Chicago Medical School, which also was a Jewish medical school. Anyway, so the nun that ran the place, and she was a great fundraiser, really a very capable woman, smart woman. And as a nun, her whole life was the hospital. So she saw me once in the hospital. I was visiting someone that was unfortunately ill. And I went out to take the elevator to go down to leave, and she said, "Oh, Rabbi, I want to talk to you." She said, "You know, July 1st is the turnover date here. In the United States, God forbid, you have to be in a hospital. Don't go July 1st. first week in July. That's when all the new interns show up and all the new residents, and nobody knows what's going on, you know. So she said, you know, July 1st is coming, and we've got some openings left, you know. She said, maybe you can get me some of those doctors with beanies. So that's a whole different world, right? A whole different world. And the fact that that Lieberman could run for vice president and be the popularly elected vice president of the United States. So anyone would have thought that the first Jew that would have run for elective office at that height, at that level, you know, would be reform, reconstructionist, assimilated. Barry Goldwater, when he ran in 1964, said, it's ironic that the first Jew in the White House will be an Episcopalian. Because his grandfather converted already. But that didn't happen, right? The first Jew was, you know, was going to be a Shomer Shabbos. He had a wife named Hadassah. And that his daughter was going to go to the Beis Yaakov in Silver Spring. So that's a remarkable sea change in American Jewish life. How it will play out, no one knows. Again, these are all... But the point is that, you know, we have to start to think out of the box a little, because it's a whole different world, both in America and in Israel. A whole different world. And even here in Israel, there are large pockets of, quote, secular Jews who are not really secular. They're ignorant. They may be estranged. The religious establishment turns them off, which is also understandable. But they're searching. They want to be, you know, they're looking for something. For the first time in many, many decades, you had kibbutzim, as many as 60, 70 kibbutzim that insisted that you send them young men to make high holiday services for them, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, in the kibbutz. See the letters that were received afterwards, you know, what have you saved us? So there is movement. The latest poll, which was published a few weeks ago, so 20 years ago, 40% of the population defined itself as secular. In the latest poll, it went down to 20%.
This is what drives them crazy.
What are the other 8% saying?
55-60% said that they're religious or traditional, but the other ones would not define themselves as secular. So again, these are the problems that we face, but the problems are old, you know. I think that to deal with them in the terms of how we dealt with them 150 years ago may not work today. So if you have any good ideas, let me know. Thanks. Good being here.
Thanks a lot. Tomorrow is on schedule.
Yes.
Thanks for everything.
Thank you.